Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her.
Welcome to Yin Radio. I'm Sandy Billings, bringing you a show about power. The components of the program come mostly, but not entirely, from previous Yin Radio shows from March and May of 2008, and they've been carefully selected for this collection. It's a power encore, and it's an eclectic collection. Names and the power they have to shape us and call us start the program off. The power of names is followed by a woman named Power. Author Susan Power shares her powerful piece of poetry that she calls a rant. It is political as well as personal. Then we talk about the power of voice in two pieces. A brief one from a woman who learned to use her voice to command authority. And that is followed by a longer piece from a woman who lost her vocal power. That one's from Joy Passanante, reading from her story, My Red Dress Voice. I'll wrap up the show with a story from our ancestral, cultural, and religious roots. It's a piece I wrote about the power of blood, and it covers the gamut of life, death, birth, and rebirth. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and our show today is about power. Installment number one. Our names are so important to us. In May of this year, when I told a friend I was doing a show on names, she said the power to name was huge. Huge. So I turned on the recorder and asked her, Sarah, as she did some dishes, why she thinks the power to name is huge.
Because, I mean, I think that a name can really make a person or a dog or whatever be who they become. Like if your name, like my name, for instance, is Sarah, and my mom really wanted to call me Daisy. And I think that if I were a Daisy, I would be different. Mm-hmm. And my dad was like, I don't want him to be no hippie. So
they help shape who you are.
I think they do. I really do. And
do you think people sometimes have the wrong name?
Yeah.
And need to change it?
Yeah. Yeah. My husband, for instance, did change his name.
Oh.
Not legally. He just has a permanent nickname that everybody calls him. So he just changed it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. His mom really, really thought hard about his name and loves that his name is Brian, but he goes by Ellis, and so that's just, it's just different, you know. But to me, that's how I met him, and he absolutely, positively is an Ellis. Mm-hmm. But to her, he's a Brian. So I, you know, but to himself, I do think that he's an Ellis. Yeah. That's what he introduces himself as, and you know, it's just, it is big.
The power to give a name is huge, but so is the power to select and change your name. Naming is like labeling or describing, and a good label is part of good marketing. The marketing of a name works not only on those who are looking at us, but the names work on us. So in other words, I don't believe that old sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me rhyme. I do think bad names send bad messages, and eventually they dig into our skin. At another angle, at a reading last month, author Susan Power touched on the importance of names twice during her short reading. First, the character she was reading told how she got her name.
I got my name because of the way I came into the world. I was early. You know, I took my mother by surprise. She was all alone in our little shack doing quill work when her water broke. And then, so soon after that, I came tumbling out. She said it felt like I did all the work, swam and pushed and tore away from her because I was ready to get started. I didn't cry. I sighed with satisfaction, the way the Creator must have when he set this world in motion. I approved of my birth and was pleased. So they called me Ogiman Gishigukwe, Chief Woman of the Sky, because I was bossy from the first minute.
Now, again, later in the same reading, Susan Power touched again on names, the power of names to call people in deeper and more mysterious ways than simply calling them to dinner.
You might notice that as I'm telling you this, I haven't used his name. I say my first husband, or him, because if I speak his name now that he is gone, it is like calling his spirit, and I don't want to do that. I want his spirit to stay wherever it is.
Those last clips were from Susan Power reading from her upcoming novel. Because Susan's stories incorporated the importance of naming and birthing, I had also asked Susan to tell me about the importance of names as relates to her own name.
First, let me say, I mention in here my mother. I call her the Gathering of Storm Clouds Woman, and that is her Dakota name. It's Machpea Bohawi, which means Gathering of Storm Clouds Woman, or Stormy for short. And her siblings have said, oh, yeah, it was a good name. So my name was given to me. In my tribe, you're supposed to give your name only once to one person. And my grandmother gave me her name, which is Wanach Chawashdewi, which is the name of a prairie flower that is, it's pretty, but it's really stronger than you think. It sort of survives in really rugged desert-like terrain. Maybe that's appropriate. But Susan, my parents just gave me the two most boring names in the universe, Susan and Mary, and stuck them together. I don't know. And Power comes from the Irish side, actually, of the family. And apparently there's a town somewhere in Ireland where there are an awful lot of people with that name running around. Yeah, I like it. I don't know. Now I've grown into it, and now I think I've claimed it as meaning more.
Scratch your name into the fabric of this world. Before you go, the skin will tear under the pressure, make it deep. So it always shows.
The second installment of our program is also from Susan Power. And we see that, while she didn't choose her name, she wears it fully. She uses power in her words and voice and expression as she reads this next piece. It's a poem. Perhaps it should be called slam poetry if you need to name and categorize it. She calls it a rant. Here's Susan Power railing against the American version of history.
In school, I am shy, bookish, polite. I sit on my hands until the Indian in me erupts from her wooden post in the back of the room. Sometimes it's just too much, and I wave my hand in the air and hear myself speak with a vigor so unexpected it turns every head. They're praising Custer again and his Shirley Temple-like curls of gold. It's the gold we should talk about now, his metal fever. They say we crossed the Bering Strait in a chilly migration from Russian lands, when all of us know we grew from this ground like corn, or fell from the sky like ripe seeds in the pocket of our mother's dress. They tell me our women were oppressed, worked like mules by lazy men, and they don't want to hear my grandma's name or write it down. Josephine Gates Kelly, born 1888, tribal chairperson, head of the Standing Rock Sioux in the 1950s, when other American women are trapped in the kitchen baking pies, martini perfumed, with those red, red mouths and cone-sharp breasts, chewing tranquilizers like mints to keep them still, help them like Ike. They fall into the laudanum bed of their day. Oh, it's hopi, not hoppy, I gently say. But I do not mention that as far as I know, there is no tribe of giant rabbits in this land. And every November, the gobbler art, turkeys and pilgrims and pumpkins and Indians too, naked beneath their one stiff feather, cut from construction paper, unzipping the Thanksgiving myth that we ever broke even bread. My religious teacher, Mrs. Burns, says, Puritans suffered the grim voyage from England to the black scars of Plymouth Rock because of persecution. And I know the intolerable weight of condemnation, where a ruling order declares that your God is not God, and your prayers are worse than futile. They are the sweet stink of burnt flowers, the devil's foolishness. Yet she will not acknowledge my hand, Mrs. Burns, when it peeps in the air, wilting, ignored. She already knows the questions I'll raise, why the sins of the fatherland are played out in the old new world by folks who should have known better. Thank God for my mother's Sacagawea-like sense of direction. She points north. This gathering of storm clouds, woman, her needle forever set magnetically on activism. To rubble, people rise up and chase the money changers from the temple, dash their scales upon the stone floors. She helps me carve a space for myself and my voice in every white world I encounter from year to year and grade to grade. This is how my head is padded, my face held in a brief gesture of hopefulness by Martin Luther King when I am 3. This is how I find myself reading my middle school poems at age 11 and 12 with a lineup of literary angels like Tumbleweed, our Black Creek friend with her pom-pom braids, and Dennis Brutus, just released from prison in South Africa, bearing his colored card, his BIA-like determination of how much blood makes you more than white in Johannesburg. And this is true. For the past 12 years or so, I've had a recurring dream about my country. I see our great cities underwater, the Statue of Liberty tipped from her pedestal, not Planet of the Apes-like buried in sand, but swallowed by the great ocean that washes her face with salt. Life is spent on long boats shaped like canoes, longer even than the imagination, and natives man the oars, not rowing slave-like to a beaten drum, but purpose-driven all the same, bent by compassion. We travel this world of water to save our drowning relatives, black, white. We pluck them from the waves and sit them in the center of our boats where they huddle, stunned and chastened, ultimately grateful. I used to think this was a fiction of the mind, allegory, metaphor, or the less elegant labors of a brain churning the day's thoughts into a dull, confusing mush. But as the glaciers melt and superstorms, monstrous as Grendel, smash our houses and our lives, I see us rushing towards the future of these boats. Listen to what Joy Harjo said in a book of poems. Oh, sun, moon, stars, our other relatives peering at us from the inside of God's house. Walk with us as we climb into the next century, naked but for the stories we have of each other. Keep us from giving up in this land of nightmares, which is also the land of miracles. We were saved by our stories, our crop that never dies through every drought and dust bowl, every Himmler-like policy of death, every cultural root canal suffered in a boarding school. Don't you know we are the people of tinnitus? We cannot sleep for all the ringing in our ears. The ghosts of our ancestors sing us songs to keep us awake, 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 noisier than television sirens. Their voices gather in a crescendo of wisdom that bursts through time, a sonic boom to spill you on your ass. We have no choice but to listen eventually. Remember who we were before the pain and the painkiller, the fire water and the diabetes, the bingo palaces and welfare programs, the Ivy League schools and powwow circuits, the American dream. The strongest stories are homegrown. They didn't travel from another world. They weren't filtered through a test tube microscope, Bible injection, calculus equation, symphony of black quarter notes trapped on the page. Our stories surround us, whether they're res or urban, whether our tribe was forcibly removed or stubbornly hid in the hills, in the woods, in the swamps. They twist inside us, remarkable as DNA, insistent, generous, a lifeline thrown to each generation. What's more, they are true. No matter how inventive, preposterous, no matter how much so-called magical realism is involved. How do I know? Because they peeled me down to the core, sloughed off stories I'd learned in school. Crim law with Dershowitz, con law with Larry Tribe, Stendhal, and even Walker Percy, a kind of exfoliation of the intellect and spirit where I find myself saying what I mean and meaning what I say, where I forget how to double talk bullshit, logic my way into a righteous corner justified by footnotes citing evidence. Our sovereign stories lead us to freedom. We make it through the looking glass world of all the upside down, half-assed Indian policies that trot through history like a roll call of childhood diseases. The Allotment Act, the Indian Reorganization Act termination, the Indian Wars that never really ended but just changed venue. We emerge from madness and arrogance, prejudice and ignorance, our stories intact, stronger for the test of fire, the forge. We share them in cars, at kitchen tables, poetry slams and art exhibitions, in our novels and chapbooks and cheap motels and classrooms and shake tents and medicine lodges, funeral parlors and bars. Soon you will hear us too, buzzing hotly like bees. We will haunt you with our tales, though we are not ghosts, we are not finished, exterminated, we are not conquered, we are not lost, we are not at the end of the trail or the end of our rope, we are not a problem, a fad, a guru, a channeling queen, a pet, or a mascot, a jumble of bones in a drawer. We are old stories groping forward into every new world. We made it here by the skin of our teeth. No one can stop us now from telling and telling and telling. It is our turn to run the schools and teach you the anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance to every other being on the planet. Pull down the pyramid with a human face on top. No, that's already happening without our intervention. Don't you see? We are already building the long boats with these words.
You're listening to Yin Radio. Our show today is Power. Our voices and timbre and tone express power or give power away. Bette Christensen has learned to use her voice as a tool to command authority. After various twists and turns in life, after kids and a spouse, Beck became a corrections officer in an all-male corrections facility, also known as a prison, in Florida.
You don't question my orders.
Interesting. Yeah. But what about use of voice? Did you have to learn to use your voice differently? You have a good voice anyway. Or do you just have to project it to make it powerful?
Well, if I'm on one side of the compound and I see something going on the other side of the compound, I've got to be able to do that. But that's also part of that whole identity thing, too. I can be down by Echo Dorm, which is down by the rec yard, and see something going on up by Center Gate, and all I have to do is do this. You know, there's body language that I use with them too. And because they know it's me, they know they need to do what they've got to do. So I don't necessarily have to even use my voice a lot of times. It's just a presence that you have. I'd like to think that I don't. He may say differently. But I'd like to think that I don't use the same voice at home that I do at work, because I'm not a woman at work. I'm not a mom at work. I'm an officer. I'm in a sense genderless, even though they know I'm female. In a sense, I'm genderless, and so the voice that I use is an officer voice. I can't.
So it is an officer voice.
It is an officer voice. Absolutely. It's matter of fact. You know, and that's part of the whole thing. Your eye contact is very important. If you don't give them eye contact, and some of them see that in a threatening way, particularly if you're a woman, but I have to do that because I have to establish that I'm the one that is calling the shots here. So I have to give them eye contact. And sometimes it gets into a staring contest. It really does. And it's difficult sometimes. Some of these guys are pretty big. And even if they're not, you know, that doesn't mean they can't do you some damage. So I've got to be careful about that, and that's, you know, it's really difficult to convey to someone who isn't there really the nature of what you do, like anything else. You know, it's really hard to do that.
Well, it's hard for a lot of us to imagine putting ourselves in that position and saying, okay, I'm going to figure out how to do this. It's a role and mannerisms and, I mean, everything that goes with that role that we're not used to assuming in daily life. Like I said, when it comes to voice, I had to learn in meetings how to not do this when I really wanted to make a point. That voice just doesn't make your point, but, you know, I'm upset and this is how my voice goes.
Mm-hmm.
And instead to bring it down and be right. Very direct and say the same words, perhaps, but say them in a much stronger and clearer tone.
Right.
And, like you said, eye contact
right.
And things. And if you're not taught that, it seems hard to learn to take it on.
Some of that they cover in training, you know, but really and truly, like anything else, it's on the job. I think the only difference between this job and this respect than any other job is that you can lose your life. or another officer can lose their life, or an inmate can lose their life, or get hurt, or whatever. But it's like anything, you just learn. You learn by watching, and hopefully what you're learning is what you need to be learning. There's going to be officers just like anybody else anywhere that are not worth emulating, that you shouldn't emulate. But you look for the best, and you look for people that you respect and admire, and you look at consequences of their actions. But ultimately, you have to find your own way of doing things, your own identity, and your own strength. This job has given me much more confidence than I had before.
In general?
In general. Absolutely.
That was Beck Christensen, a corrections officer in an all-male corrections facility, talking about how she uses her voice to command authority. This next installment comes from author Joy Passanante. Her story, My Red Dress Voice, appeared in a wonderful book called Kiss Tomorrow, Hello, Notes from the Midlife Underground by 25 Women Over 40. It was edited by Kim Barnes and Claire Davis. In this installment, Joy explores the changes in her physical voice and how the voice relates to power, self-expression, and self-identity. Joy read My Red Dress Voice for Yin Radio. This is an abridged version of the story in her own voice. Joy Passanante.
My red dress voice. I am a woman who laughs. I laugh often, often inappropriately. And I don't just laugh. I bend at the waist, wrap my arms around my middle, shake my shoulders as if I'm a lead singer in a rock band, hyped up on ego and drugs. And I roll under tables, slide from chairs. I make, well, noise. People are continually commenting on my laugh and the voice that produces it. Even people I've just met and whose names I haven't caught have informed me, with varying degrees of goodwill, that my laugh is contagious, infectious, and just plain loud. I can call my insurance agent, whom I don't speak with more than once a year, or the mother of a friend I haven't seen in decades, and they will say, "Hello, Joy," as soon as they hear me ask for whomever it is I want to speak with. The sounds I make are apparently familiar, distinct. And as I stride, still muscular short legs pumping, pewter hair flying around my neck, toward what statistics indicate will be my third and final trinity of decades, I have a ripple of a suspicion that my most significant, monumental, and perhaps important escapist pleasure is this laugh. No matter how stressed I am, no matter how many problems I have spent the day enumerating or feeling helpless against, when I laugh with all the stops pulled out, I feel released. I think of a volcano, a geyser, Sisyphus on a holiday. For those seconds, I am the freest woman I can imagine. Or at least I used to be this woman. Flashback to the 60s. After I had dated my husband-to-be a few months, my parents invited him to dinner. Our relationship was in its fledgling stage, and before him, I had had the same boyfriend for years, a good-times, no-holds-barred type who had done odd, if intriguing, things to my sense of propriety. This new love of my life, Gary Williams, with his WASP name, Sunday school inhibitions, and pew-rigid work ethic, was, among other things, particularly pleasing to my parents, a book lover, on the path toward a Ph.D. in literature. He was a church-going Methodist from Montana who hadn't had anything like the Jewish-Italian Passanantes in his experience. That night, at dinner in our suburban St. Louis dining room with my parents and two younger sisters, I was a little tense. Just as my mother was about to clear away her homemade cannelloni to present her Bavarian cream with brandied chocolate sauce, my sister Judy, still in high school, began reminiscing about a long-forgotten member of her second or third grade class who had, in protest at having to return from recess, hurled a volleyball against the teacher's head. The main thrust of the penance for the class was to write a song while the teacher was at home recuperating, the refrain of which was, "We're sorry we hit you on the head with the volleyball." Face twitches, volcanic rumbling of giggles. My sister Jeannie then chimed in, And then there was the time the ninth grade geometry teacher took his small ruler out of his desk drawer and announced to the class, "When in doubt, I always whip out my trusty 6 inches." Seismic tremors. I felt my lips stretch out, my mouth open, my eyes squinch, my head fling back, and my laughter erupt. And before we knew it, all 3 of us siblings had slid down my mother's white patent leather dining room chairs to the carpet under the mahogany table, while my father, calmly spooning cannelloni into his bow-shaped Sicilian lips, looked at the bewildered young man to his right and said dryly, "They're always peeing all over themselves. Want some more pasta?" When the Passanante women were together, we laughed as if the sun were any nanosecond about to hurl itself into the woods and on the outskirts of our suburb. We laughed as if the impact of our noise could heal the have-nots and wretched of the planet, could transform dirt to diamonds. Our laughs were sudden thunderclaps, libations to the gods of pleasure and liberty. Apocalyptic, apoplectic. I learned early that my voice was my ticket to victory in the battle against ignorance, hormones, laziness, and family conflict as a teacher. While I waited for Gary to complete his degree, though I had sworn for years that I wanted to be a writer and had no intention of teaching, I said yes to teaching grades 9 through 12 at Homer High School in upstate New York. While I was struggling to master the content of the 10 different courses I was assigned that first year, I became increasingly aware of a profoundly more important responsibility: how to awaken the dormant intellects of my reluctant charges, who I just knew were waiting for that magic kiss of inspiration. And how could I, a not-quite-5-footer who had only a few years of my students, deliver this to them? Well, through my voice. And it worked. For the next 3 years, I developed and honed the habits that would give me the inside track on inspiration, not to mention popularity. I became one of those upfront, pacing around the room, in-your-face teachers who ratchet up their already loud voices and thunder up and down the spectrum of pitch to reach and engage even those who try to shrink into the back wall of the classrooms. I projected to punctuate and drive home particular points, but mostly to keep all of my 130 students each day turned toward me and tuned in. I can still hear myself bellowing out, "Et tu, Brute? Then fall, Caesar!" in such an explosive voice that it made the class and their young teacher laugh. I greedily soaked up every manifestation of positive reinforcement, the clamoring to get into my classes, the thank you notes signed love, but mostly the attentive and astounded looks on my charges' faces. Gary and I were still in our mid-20s when, just weeks after he brought his dissertation back from the bindery, we moved across the continent to launch his first job, to embark on our journey through parenthood, to a college town cradled in the undulating wheat fields of northern Idaho. I found myself suddenly stripped of identity. As I navigated the uncertain waters of my new roles as the faculty wife of the novice assistant professor and the first-time mother of a baby who had arrived in a strange land a continent away from where she was conceived, as the conversations I got sucked into at social gatherings drifted increasingly toward exchanging trivial information about our children's height charts and babysitters, I longed to feel still aligned to that spontaneous free woman I used to be. I longed to laugh with those other free women, my mother and sisters, who now lived more than 2,000 miles distant. Idaho was a foreign place to a young mother with a premature baby and a husband with his teeth set on tenure. And then, in that small and isolated community, there was nothing but us to do. So laughter took new forms. We went to party after party. Unfettered by a bra, it was the 70s, and I wanted people to notice me, but I also just wanted, literally, to feel free. I often wore an ankle-length, plunge-necked red dress, my cleavage luring the eye down to my convex belly, and I could feel the tingle of the gazes every inch along whatever flesh the red silk concealed. I remember my body, my dress, my laugh, and my voice. In some ways, I spent the rest of my young adulthood in that dress. I believe I was among the luckiest of women because, except for the few pitch-dark months when my marriage plunged me into depression, I felt damned good about myself. Even in a sweatshirt and jeans, I could conjure up the way I felt in that dress, spinning out for myself, experimenting with words and phrases, collecting, if not always alluring looks, then at least admirers for being so uninhibited, so cocksure. It was the transitional era between Woodstock and disco, and on scuffed platforms and bars and in living rooms of friends who slid back the furniture and clicked on the boom box, I danced in that dress wildly, arms above my head, neck stretched, sometimes shimmying in a back bend until my hair grazed the floor. And slowly, incrementally, year by year, I found another version of the laugh of the red dress, another kind of voice. When my children were napping or visiting their grandparents, and more often later when they were riding the middle-class merry-go-round of dance lessons and cheerleading practice and slumber parties, I began to ride again. To my surprise, this wasn't the same voice I had left behind in graduate school. This voice was erotic, a typed-out and in-print version of the red dress. I wrote on the electric typewriter my parents had given Gary to use for his dissertation. I wrote on hikes, using a yellow pad. I wrote while the kids slept. I wrote while I was supposed to be cleaning the house or doing laundry. I wrote when I knew my husband would be angry about the counters being dirty, the living room scattered with toys. And as I heard the red dress voice boom from page after page, self-confidence oozed from me. I was hot and free. A pinnacle of still youthful energy. I had my voice. I also started teaching again as a lecturer in the university's English department, and in some ways my fiction writing voice and the red dress influenced my classroom voice. I explained, I cajoled, I elucidated, I mollified, and I exemplified in the same way I had in those earlier days. That is, I boomed until I croaked. But I also suspect that radiating from this repertoire of voices was more than a suggestion of seduction. As a sideline to my university teaching, I began to give presentations on business writing to banks and organizations. I had to muster enormous amounts of vocal energy. In my youth, after some assiduous preparation, I could present for an 8-hour day. Someone would have had to hook a cane around my neck to extract me from the podium. I once kept up my combination of informative banter and laughter for a regional telephone company for 6 straight hours, forgetting to give the participants a break. The lesson was focused on what standard business form letter phrases not to use. I can still hear my voice scream out my favorite example. "May I take the liberty?" I said, mocking the phrase in my highest volume, perilously low-pitched voice. "May I take the liberty?" I repeated, my voice ricocheting off the hotel's conference room walls. "The answer is no, N-O." And one evening, after I had lectured to a bank group for 2.5 days, I realized my chest and throat and some other spot I couldn't quite place inside me between my chin and stomach actually hurt. I sounded like a man pretending to be Lauren Bacall. But I ignored my pain. Yes, pain, I'll admit now. I've been humbled by the powerful and pesky god of irony, the one who had apparently been watching the woman who flashed at the world in red. One April morning, after a few days stiffing my way through a sinus infection, I wake up immediately knowing something is wrong. Gary, now my husband of over 30 years, has brought me my coffee in bed, our morning ritual, and I open my mouth, flex my throat muscles, move my tongue, but nothing comes out. I squeak, but squeaking hurts. Suddenly I flash back on a party 3 decades before. The party lasted until 4 a.m., and I, who had had a bout with laryngitis following the flu, prophetic, I see now, spoke over the alcohol-infested din, alternately in my husky, it's too smoky in here voice, and in the high-pitched staccato of Minnie Mouse. At the time, it made us laugh. Now, on what should have been an ordinary spring day, I struggle to activate or capture or energize or even just plain find the muscles farther down in my chest. Nothing. I grab a pen in the back of a receipt. I can't talk, I write in a shorthand I will get to know all too well. Call office, sick leave today. Today stretched into 3, then 5. I try to be practical, assess my lifestyle. I'm a teacher. I imagine a musician without her instrument, a policeman without his gun. And Gary and I are social folks. We have a wine tasting group, a commitment to grad students to attend their monthly symposia, an obligation to hear readings from visiting writers and poets, an expectation that we will host receptions, a propensity for candlelit dinner parties around our large dining table. And besides, I have things to say. I call the local doc, get a prescription for an antibiotic. Take it. Still, no sound. Now, panic creeps into my sleep, and I am jolted awake. I travel the 90 miles to Spokane to see an otolaryngologist who gives me steroids, a prescription for voice therapy, and a diagnosis. Dysphonia. This, he explains, is a voice disorder, and my particular kind involves a swelling and inflammation in the vocal cords. Over the next several weeks, I, who have bragged in every class for years about how I have been absent for only 4 days in my career, and that for major surgery, stay at home from school. I walk the dog, but cannot give her the expected commands or praise her. I cannot call Gary to ask him to pick something up at the store for dinner. When the postal carrier brings me a package, I cannot thank him. I cannot talk to my children or sisters or mother on the phone. When a friend has a small birthday celebration for me, I have to mouth the words I want to say, watch the others talking to one another, and I am the first one to leave. I feel ineffectual, hollow, and I cannot laugh. I begin to see my voice as a visitor. I have no ownership rights over it. Maybe it is just a scarlet feathered bird nesting in my body. It is my fortune, and I am aware that it might disappear forever. After the steroids kick in and I somehow finish the semester, I go to voice therapy. I am dutiful. I attend twice a week. This process might take as much as an entire semester, my therapist projects. The first semester, I practice with her tapes, speak at a higher pitch, speak at a lower volume, try not to speak at all. I do my homework sporadically, not confident that there is a cure for me. I practice techniques to help me relax. My friends asked, did they ever find out what it was? Dysphonia, I try to explain, sounding like a website labeled Voice Problems 101. Stress makes acid in my stomach rise into my voice box. And then there was that sinus infection or virus or whatever it was, and here's the one that saddens me and in some sense embarrasses me. Nearly a lifetime of abuse of my voice. These friends are solicitous. I have sent them emails saying that I need to rest my voice, but they call anyway. I tell them I can't talk long because I'm not allowed to. Sometimes the notion of this restriction elicits a chuckle. Or, I'm so sorry about your laryngitis, they say. It's not laryngitis. It has nothing to do with laryngitis. I tell them I can't talk long because my voice hurts. You sound fine, they retort, no doubt trying to be supportive. But I am by this time well trained. I can envision my bloated vocal folds, hear them smacking together, grating, jockeying for room in my throat on their way up the larynx. And I can sympathize with them, my sad, swollen folds, as if they are unattached to me, just distant relatives, as they strain to find room to vibrate unencumbered and produce sound. Well, it isn't really fine, I say, wondering why I feel defensive, why I have to be defensive. Whatever, they'll add perhaps. But the next time, whoever it was, will ask me the same question. Whatever, I keep trying to think. but it suddenly matters that people know what is really happening to me. I have turned inward like a tunnel of air in me, my voice trapped and flapping inside it like that of a bird. The voice trying to fly from within my neck, fly out into someone else. I think, can you hear me? One day, my therapist says something mildly amusing and I laugh. The disembodied sounds I make crack in the air. She draws back, says, ouch! My heart steps up. You've got to muffle your laugh, she says. Can you hear what you're doing to your vocal cords? After that, I find myself smiling and nodding more when I want to burst. Still, even nodding hurts that elusive place in my throat. My out-of-therapy life is a jumble of strained discussions during which I croak or squeak or develop the breaking staccato syllables of an eighth-grade boy being dragged into puberty by forces beyond his understanding. My voice is choked with gravel. A colleague offers, "We're hoping you can come to the gathering we're having on Saturday night. You're always the life of the party." Immediately, my heart kicks into gear. I clench my fists. I know this is a script that is yellowing in the trash can. I replay a fleeting image of myself holding forth, deploying wisecracks, stories, jokes at my own expense, my friend's pleasure and mine swelling with the volume, with the laughter. The one semester of therapy stretches into two, during which I'm advised to take sick leave from work, then a summer. My therapist, though she admits that I've made some improvements, declares she doesn't understand why I'm not substantially better. She brings in a singing coach to assess my way of lecturing in class and show me how to stand, how to align my throat with my vocal cords, how to breathe from my diaphragm. In other words, how to change my entire teaching style. My therapist's student assistant also makes a stab at my case, and when her efforts fail, too, she pop-psychs me. Do you think you're not making progress because you don't want to be a quiet person? Since I want to please my therapist, as if that were a measure of success, my head nods as if I am considering, perhaps even agreeing with this analysis, but my heart scoffs. Silly, ridiculous, absurd. And yet, now that my consciousness, as well as my vocal cords, are many months older, I wonder. My identity seems suddenly, almost impossibly, tenuous and elusive. I memorize my 2-page rules for vocal hygiene, which I keep crumpled in my backpack, and set about the process of learning that my vocal cords are too large, the sounds I have spent my youth and much of my middle age throwing out to the world too intense. That I have to relax. Relax, my therapist keeps repeating, trying hard to inculcate a mantra to chant me through the silence into the world of sound. Phrases like hard glottal attack, laryngeal tension reduction, easy onset, lower intensity, which form the lexicon for my semi-weekly therapy sessions, seem like the least poetic and appealing words I've ever heard. And it begins to strike me slowly, like a chiming bell at a Buddhist funeral, that I am becoming the least poetic and appealing rendition of me that I've ever known. I have to learn new tricks, how to loosen my jaw muscles, how to align backbone, hip, shoulder, ear, how to wait for others to stop talking before I utter a sound, how to respond to someone without voicing, how to lower the volume and raise the pitch, how to steer clear of the bottomless pitfalls of smoke and dust and furnaces and restaurants and dances and traffic and running water and background music, which all now say one thing, danger. The trade-off is clear. I have to change everything, it seems. The way I hold my body, the way I open my mouth, the way I cough and clear my throat, even the way I breathe. And, of course, the way I laugh. The alternative? A lifetime of silence. But this threat for me has an even more alarming consequence, that I will be confined to a lifetime of being someone else. When I finally return to work and to parties, I feel like a child in an aging adult body. I am muted. I speak through cotton, or perhaps, on days when I feel better about myself, layers of silk. But not red silk. That red dress seemed destined to remain in the closet under some dusty cover. Even so, I could say that in my 50s, I now have wisdom to bestow, and that I dreadfully miss a reliable voice to do this. Oh, what I could tell my ingenuous students, my newly adult children, and with my precise and amply informed choice of words, how I could use my voice to open windows and doorways onto the world. But a chilling honesty has taken root in me, and the truth is that as I age, I want to reflect more, want to give less. Perhaps my fragile and mercurial voice has presented a way of easing me into the life I am being invisibly escorted into on the twin arms of biology and fate. Now I know it's just a matter of time. I go to a party and try to pretend I am not there. I wander around the room, examining the photographs on the wall. I am not, needless to say, wearing a red dress. I hear myself laugh, and I sound like my laugh is creeping up to the surface through blankets, through straw, through dirt. It's buried. I'm my own ventriloquist, my own dummy. I am going through the motions, for social purposes, I might say, but I'd be lying. I'm going through them so that I can be part of the group. I dance, but when my partner talks to me during the dance, I can't respond in words. He thinks I am not having fun, or that he has garlic breath, or, well, who knows? It's what I think that counts. I think I feel self-conscious. The deepest panic here arises not from the being quiet, I can do that, but from the fear that I have little to say. Saying little, or, why not admit it, saying nothing, like my multiple ways of abusing my voice, is threatening to become a habit. An odd transformation has been taking place against my will, but it seems not lodged so much in my vocal cords as in my cranium. What do I have to say? What if no voice equates with no words? The words swing through my brain and clatter inside my chest. Feelings no longer leave my body in the form of recognizable syllables that impart meaning. They're there, but since they can't link themselves to words, they float away. And my laugh, too, seems detached from my voice. Maybe it's that life is less funny. Maybe it's that my sisters are too far away. But now I feel everything is filtered through a flannel lining. Sometimes, when my problems tug at me and threaten to pull me under, I look around for something to laugh at, just to test myself, perhaps to make sure I am still here. But I think I am past that moment, or month, or year, of panic. The red dress may be gone, so be it. But I feel, now, I need a different voice, a sottovoce voice, to sustain who I am. One day, near the end of my year of therapy, I have coffee with a young man who asked me to serve on his thesis committee. Yes, I say, certainly. But what I want to say are the things that I wanted to say years ago before my years flew away. I want to spew off words at a hearty volume without so much as a forethought. I want some of them to be unpredictable and spontaneous, to teeter on the edgy and outrageous. I want to laugh in a thunderclap, and I'm about to be forlorn when I abruptly think I can feel a new voice swimming up into some sort of shape, though I don't think the shape is English or even recognizable syllables. That voice under my voice is silken, delicate as a cream-colored orchid, and it bubbles up under the tongue, delivering gorgeous words like mellifluent or millennium, lugubrious or languid, to the clarified air. And then the cadences of sentences, the love affair between tongue and throat. My voice is still dancing, but now, instead of shimmying untamed, it's doing a tango, handsome and admirable in its control, a snug embrace, a shadow kick here and there, a rock to the fan position, reverse promenade, swivel to tango close, a cream-colored orchid bobbing with every sweep and sway. Can you see this? Oh, my future listeners, can you hear me?
That was Joy Passanante reading an abridged version of her short story, My Red Dress Voice, on our Yin Radio Power Show. And closing today's show is a piece about religious stories. It's called Power in the Blood.
I'm going to tell you a little story. Long ago, before people wrote things down, things were not so different than they are today. Women had babies, born in pain and blood, who grew into children. The boys and girls played, romped, and discovered. They imitated adults so that they could learn how to be men and women. Boys learned to be tough, to run fast, not to cry at pain or at the pain of others. It made them better hunters. Girls learned to gather and make food and to care for each other and for the little ones. Eventually, the girls would bleed and not die, and then they would be able to have children themselves. Their children would be born in pain and blood. We are removed from the blood. It is hidden, as secret as tampons in purses, secret as monthly doses of Midol, and hidden in hospital maternity wards. But this remains true to this day. Blood was a fact in the men's lives, too. As hunters, they lived by bloodshed. Killing an animal was certainly a bloodier affair than today, and not all the blood would be that of the prey. A hunting party would be likely to injure an animal, especially large prey, with its arrows and knives and blow darts. And if the animal escapes with injuries, a blood trail might still give the hunters a chance. When too much blood is lost, the animal will stumble, fall, and die at the end of the trail. Perhaps the hunters will find the animal before it dies, weak and facing death, face to face, hunters and animals. The animal struggling for its lives. Hooves and horns and teeth and legs are all dangerous weapons. Hunters and prey bleed, blood mixes, and the men strive to staunch the flow of their own blood, lest they die along with the prey. It could just as easily be the men as the animals who die. The connection between life and blood were obvious. Lose too much blood and death comes. But the converse is also true. When blood is shed and death comes to one, life comes to the other. The flesh of the slain animal provides life for the hunters and the tribe. We are removed from the bloodletting. It is hidden in slaughterhouses, processing plants, and butcher shops. But this remains true to this day. So does loss of blood bring death. With one exception, women bleed every month, yet do not die. When this begins for a girl, it marks the time at which she has a new ability, the ability to bring forth life. So does loss of blood bring forth life. Not only does the young woman now bleed, making her a bearer of life, but the babies are born in a wash of blood. This remarkable ability of women to bleed without dying, connected with the mystery of birth, is magical and mystical and sacred. Women were seen as powerful for these abilities. Women in their moon time, as the bleeding time is known in many cultures, were known to be at the height of their power. And for this reason, women led many of the sacred practices around the world. The first religions honored the Creator, the bringer of life. The Creator was seen as first woman, the one who, through birth, gave all creatures life. As men began to take their places at the altars and lead sacred practices, they needed to call on the power of blood in order to preserve the life of the communities they served. Their blood power was limited, for they could not bleed and still live. They turned instead to the blood power they knew best and was most sacred to hunters, the blood of animals. So animals were no longer hunted, but were herded. They were still precious and provided for human life by their deaths. The bloodletting was still sacred, but no longer as much of a struggle. So by sacrificing animals, blood could be let solely for sacred purposes, as an offering to creators, who no longer were seen as giving birth themselves, but were imaged and imagined as men. Without their own blood to give and without the ability to bear life, the men who led the practices used the blood supplied by the to the life-giving processes by proxy of the animals. We are now removed from the blood of sacrifice. It is hidden in the stories of past sacrifice, but this remains true to this day. For today, the story of Jesus captures all the magic, mystery, and sacredness of blood, death, birth, and life. For in that story, Jesus was sacrificed and bled. And like women, he did not really die, but he rose again, and even so, as in doing so, brought forth life in heaven for his children. But then again, like men, he did die, even if for a while. And like prey, his death provided a way for people to live eternal life in heaven forever. Knowledge of the connection between death and life, blood and birth, is deep in our beings. Perhaps it's in our genes. Perhaps it is so intimately connected with humanness that we will never disremember it. And it is necessary that stories of life in heaven or earth come by way of blood. And it is well known that the loss of blood brings death to all creatures, with the miraculous exception of the blood that is associated with birth. That blood brings life. That blood is powerful. We are removed from the power of blood. It is hidden, but it remains true to this day.
Would you be free from the burden of sin? There's power in the blood, power in the blood. Would you or evil love victory win? There's wonderful power in the blood.
Power, wonder-working power in the blood.
You're listening to Yin Radio. We're going to go out with power. Thanks for joining me today on Yin Radio. You can reach me at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Y-I-N radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Or you can call 208-882-1626. Thanks today to Sarah Cuxey, Susan Power, Beck Christensen, and Joy Passanante for contributions to today's show. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by me, your host, Sandy Billings, and by VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.